Hello and welcome to the Spirit World Center. The following is the Spirit World Center podcast. If you have any questions about the spirits or training, you can visit our website at spiritworldcenter.com. And now, please enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the Spirit World Center. Today, I am once again joined by Peter Mark Adams. And this time, I think this is his third appearance with us. We're going to be talking about the Egyptian mysteries, and this is going to be a treat. How are you today, Peter?
Great. Thank you, Eric. It's been 1.5 years since we last spoke. So I think last time we talked about Mystai, the Dionysian mysteries. So this is kind of continuum of that, I guess, in some ways.
Yeah. So today we've gathered to talk about the Egyptian mysteries. And this is an absolutely huge subject, but I think we're going to be delving into a lot of fascinating trends and changes and ideas that emerge from Egypt that have influenced us throughout the world and throughout time. But before we get started, what would you say if someone just heard this term for the first time, what would you say the Egyptian mysteries are?
I mean, every mystery cult is essentially an introduction to a deity. And when I say an introduction, you actually merge your awareness with the deity for a period of time. And that affects a fundamental shift in your perception of life and death, in the sense that it kind of relativizes, if that's a good word, I'm not sure, relativizes the dominance of our persona in its day-to-day pursuits. Whereas before, it's kind of all-encompassing and in fear of death. Afterwards, it has a smaller role in our life. We have a bigger perspective because of this deity consciousness we shared for a very short period of time. And the sense of continuity from life to life that form of consciousness gives you. And this essentially is that, I mean, if we're to look for the root of the mysteries, we have to go back to the Upper Paleolithic cave art. And you know, in rock shelters and in the depths of caves, you'll find groups of people who look like worshippers worshipping very large figures. Okay. And the strange thing is the large figure is like reflected into the way in which the smaller figures are depicted. So they're sharing something, okay? And this kind of cave art goes right through to the Neolithic. So we're talking about a tradition, it seems to me, of ritually invoking a deity, becoming possessed by that in a kind of shamanic sense, which lasted for the better part of 30,000 years plus and accompanied every step in human cultural evolution.
I think that's so key. When you really have to experience that type of spiritual practice in order to really kind of get it, right? To see what's possible. I remember when I was very young, I guess I took on this more naturalistic and materialistic version of understanding ancient religion, where, you know, we're taught in the school books, it seems, that these were people who were trying to explain natural phenomena. And so they created these kind of supernatural stories to explain it. And then a priesthood develops to keep those forces happy. And it's really just this narrative building to explain the world around them, as opposed to really trusting that there's actually a part of human experience that has been lost that we don't have access to in the modern age, which is actually direct connection with something bigger than us. And that it's not this, you know, mental form of trying to explain the universe by basically creating a proto-science that is ancient religion, but rather it's about connecting with the heart. It's about actually having these felt experiences of connecting with something far bigger than you, and then bringing that back and working with that in your society. So ultimately, it's something very alien to the modern view, would you say?
Absolutely, yeah. For me, you know, one of the really compelling texts that I'd advise everyone just take a look at is Philip DeScola's Beyond Nature and Culture. It's an anthropological text, okay? But in there, he sets out four fundamental ideologies, let's call them. One is naturalism, and the other three are animism, totemism, and analogism. What these boil down to is naturalism is our common sense view of reality, which is what you see is what you get. Animism is the view that everything is imbued with spirit and personhood. It's not just panpsychism, okay? It's personhood. And, well, I think a lot of us who are interested in broadly New Age and spiritual topics are sympathetic to an animist perspective. It tends to remain a kind of ideological commitment. Okay, because it's a leap to get into that way of relating to reality as fully and wholly alive on so many different levels, including spirits and deities and animals and plants and trees, this vast world of personhoods to which you can relate, and to which you owe an obligation to relate in a humane way, okay? That is not the way most of us are educated and encultured.
And
modernity, right?
And we were mentioning this before the interview as well, and absolutely, it's a real divide where you can try to understand animism with the mind. But the fact of the matter is that even when I find, at least, that when I'm engaging with spiritual practices that lead one to realize and feel intimately that there is consciousness in a tree, in a rock, in everything, and personhood, it's something that's experienced more through the heart, through the intuition, through the spiritual side of you. And I find that that's not so easily accessed through the mind. And so it's a completely different way of engaging, and you actually have to shut off your mind. And so this isn't something about, the games that the mind plays, like logic or rationality. You can't prove to yourself through logic that there is a consciousness in this rock, but it's something that you can feel when you attune yourself to it. And so I would almost wonder, do you feel that ancient civilizations like Egypt were more attuned with their heart, or do you think they were kind of still like us, but, you know, there's like a priest class that was connecting with the divine through these rituals, or do you think that that ancient peoples, especially Egypt, were very different from us?
In fact, you know, any pre-modern society looked at closely, which is one of the reasons I'm recommending DeScola, is that he cites so many ethnographic studies, which are so radical in the sense of reporting perspectives on day-to-day life, which are way out from our perspective. Okay, so this is the lived reality in pre-modern culture, ancient and modern. Okay, so there are very few pre-modern cultures left surviving. So, you know, it's not something we need to push back into the ancient past. It's a present for a lot of people, but not many, you know, a dwindling band, let's say. But it impacts things like, for instance, pre-modern notions of identity. So one of the confusions with Egyptology is they have this thing called the bar and another thing called the car, and then they have an akh, and they have about half a dozen other terms. And so people are saying, well, what does this mean? And of course, all we can do is attempt a translation to draw those concepts back over the fence, so to speak, into our world and find some parallels in modernity. And of course, there aren't any. I call the bar the soul doesn't actually illuminate anything.
Right. Okay. What do you think was happening with all these various parts of the soul? Like, do okay, you...
Let me answer that in a roundabout way. One of the defining texts was Fraser's Golden Bough, in the emergence of a comprehensive Western view of pre-modernity. But in that, he as well couldn't figure out how these people built houses, canoes, hunting, and at the same time did all this magical stuff. That was profoundly puzzling to him. And like the Victorian and early 20th century explanation for this was, it's primitivism. These people are primitive. Okay. When Ludwig Wittgenstein read these texts in Cambridge in the winter of 38, 39, he says, Fraser just doesn't get it. He says he doesn't understand that what these people are doing is performative. It's not the kind of naturalistic, logical sequence of steps that we assimilate everything to, which is the building houses, making canoes, fashioning weapons. There's another element in human thought which is purely performative, and the performative gives access to modes of awareness that are not otherwise accessible. And this is what Fraser and most of people in the West were missing when they looked at pre-modern culture. Ritual performativity changes the functioning of the fundamental modes of awareness, and it opens the gateway to directly accessing spirit worlds. Okay. I don't know. That's kind of a long-winded answer, but...
No, I couldn't agree more, though. I think that's a very important point to make, is that this is all practical stuff. That's the thing, right?
It's all practical stuff. Yeah, you just have to know how to go about it.
Right. It's not just sitting there and reading a liturgy and thinking about the divine. It's actually taking steps to experience it. And if you're in a culture that is not as closely connected to connecting with the divine, it can seem very bewildering.
Absolutely. So it's the loss of performativity in modernity which has left us high and dry spiritually. Okay. That tradition is broken effectively. So most people engaged in esoteric practice are kind of scrambling around to resurrect a performativity that gives access to those other modes of awareness. One way of thinking about it is that, anyway.
Absolutely. I mean, if you're living in a world where there are spirits, I mean, people will always be involved in a very intimate way with their spirits. I mean, I was thinking even the Roman practice of having a statue of the genius loci in the house. And, you know, you have to give it offerings and work with it so that your house doesn't burn down, right? I mean, this is all, it very much puts you, and frankly, it empowers you to directly engage with the divine as opposed to using an intermediary.
Yeah. And so when you're trying to understand ancient Egypt, you know, you get the fact that they, for instance, did these rituals, and the rituals were based on the myth cycles of the gods. And they made reliefs and papyri, which also depicted the ritual. So by analogy, you have the gods enacting, ritualists reenacting, and then depictions reenacting. And they're all efficacious in the Egyptian perspective, because there's an analogism connecting them. And this notion went on until the 17th century, at least in Europe, by the way. It was called the signatorial art of understanding how, for instance, a god and then a planet and then a set of minerals, crystals, plants, all had a...
How they all resonate.
Intimate resonance with each other. That's no different from ancient Egypt to 17th century Europe. So we've lived with this stuff for millennia.
And yet it's so clear how difficult it is to, for our modern minds to wrap around, well, for a mind that was schooled in modernity, to wrap ourselves around that idea of, different things resonating, like
yeah,
planet Mars resonating with the color red and with aggression. And I find that when people pick up various esoteric traditions, that's actually one of the toughest things for people to wrap their minds around. Like,
yeah, it doesn't make sense, does it?
What's all these columns of correspondence? Like, what is this? But once you unlock that, it awakens so many possibilities, right? It because that analogy, that an analogical thinking, it opens up so many ways in which you can connect with then these big spiritual energies out there, right? So if you want to, if you're going to war and you need that aggression and that will to live and to overthrow, then you wear red, or you connect with the planet Mars in some way. You do astrological work when Mars is at its height. Like you do that sort of thing to connect with those energies. And it really is the basis of magic. It's the basis of so many esoteric practices for connecting. And yet it's so foreign to the modern mind.
So we talked briefly about identity and the scattered identities of pre-modernity, right?
Yes. Yes.
Now we talked about analogism, which is the connectivity based on shared qualities. Okay.
Right.
There's another one we can talk about, which is the, the role of the ancestors in pre-modern societies is absolutely overwhelming. And that's not something which is particularly to the forefront of most modern minds, right?
You're not gonna lie, I don't think I've ever heard someone talk about the role of ancestors in, let's say, ancient Egypt. So,
okay, we need to talk about that.
What do we know? What do we know?
We do know because every funeral rite that's depicted in one of the first ritual acts that takes place is a dance. It's always a dance of figures called Mu, Mu dancers, who represent the ancestors. Okay. And this dance goes on up to the entrance to the tomb, at which point the Mu dancers don't go any further. So, okay, we scan the African horizon for a context for this. And we find that ancestry is the determining factor in your day-to-day fate. Now, this is a strange idea for us, but take Bert Hellinger's work in Africa. And he noticed that these Zulu rituals were able to, so to speak, summon ancestors and reconcile past wrongs. And from that, he emerged constellation therapy. Family constellation therapy is based on Zulu ritual activity. Okay. So when we practice family constellation therapy, the people who represent your family network, even if they're long dead and gone, doesn't matter, become imbued with the thoughts and feelings of those people. And then the therapist can reconcile the conflicts within the family line. So all of a sudden, a fundamental concept from Africa, which is outside of the scope of modernity, of modern psychology, you can experience for yourself by going along to family constellation therapy and attending a few sessions just as a participating observer. Okay. So the characteristic of that constellation is that it is a ritual space. It has an energy. And that energy gives your awareness access to domains of intentionality and thought and feeling, which are atemporal. Okay. So immediately you're in woo-woo land there.
I can see how it's going to play out.
It's that simple.
Because absolutely, you know, you're bringing that concretion of your ancestral energies with you all the time.
All the time. You're never free of it.
I can see how that is going to play an influence on how Egyptian religion unfolds for you. Like what you mentioned that your ancestry played a role in how you worshipped. Can you give some examples of that?
Okay, so the work I'm doing is in like two phases. There's like early initiatory ritual practices, and then I'm looking at the Temple of Luxor. And during the New Kingdom, there was a very specific way of becoming a ruler. You had to be born of the god Amun. So the reliefs in that part of the building depict how the person representing the ruler's mother becomes immaculately conceives a child from Amun, which is then announced to her by Thoth, and then she ritually gives birth to the ruler, effectively. But of course, right. this is the myth cycle. Okay, we don't know what the ritual practice was, but what right. we're doing here is connecting the ruler to the Ka of all the rulers that ever ruled Egypt, because they were all the son of Amun.
Right.
Okay, so right. the Egyptians had a concept. The ancestry of royal rulers is a thing, and you can connect the new ruler to that, at which point they become possessed by it. They become
once again, an analogical. Yeah,
sorry?
It's that analogical thinking once again, that if it engages and practices and has the same origin story, it is actually the same being. It's possessed with the same energy.
Yeah. And right. and being possessed of that ruler energy now, they can become a portal to the people, to the land, to the fertility of the land and the animals. Okay. And I probably mentioned this in our chat before, but this exactly mirrors concepts of African divine kingship. They're no different in the anthropological records of the 30s and 40s that, as we mentioned earlier, where the anthropological studies done in these tribal settings describe these processes. Okay, they were alive and functioning and may well still be alive and functioning today in the ethnographic records. So and one of the characteristics of that divine kingship is the king embodies this energy to such an extent that he cannot be allowed to, so to speak, breathe his dying breath into the land and the people. And so there was a practice of ritual strangulation at the point of death, so that the breath was just cut rather than affecting the entire land and its people. Okay. So the other side of the fence of animism has consequences in terms of how you live your life and what you do and how you interact with these forces.
Right, okay. Right. Yeah. It's
just as our day-to-day ethical actions are in the field.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that stuff we're picking up in constellation therapy is the result of actions taken by people, which were right. largely unjust. That's the kind of stuff that surfaces and that disturbs the ancestral line.
Right.
Even, you know, okay. So So it's also pointing to the fact that the texture of reality is an ethical field. It's not value free.
And so then that raises the possibility of living it correctly, of surfing these waves correctly. And then what is possible if you have an entire city state or civilization that's actually engaged in incorrect navigation of ancestral energies and bringing in these various possibilities. I mean, something that strikes me is, it can seem a little, it can almost seem backwards to deify a person, right? To say, oh, this is our king and he's a god, right? But I wonder.
Certainly not democratic.
I wonder, in that situation, is there a distinction made between the personality of that individual and what is inhabiting that individual? Moses was a boy before and he had this personality, but then something happens to him, and when he rises to the throne, there's something else with him. Now do you see a sense of that?
I mean, again, it's a form of possession cult, isn't it? In this case, the possession is by the ruling car of the people, which is figured in terms of being a gateway to your people. It's almost as though there's no persona here. And if we look at the practice of kingship in Egypt, for instance, they get up at 4 in the morning and start a long 2 or 3 hour process of ritual cleansing and purification and dedication. Then they go to the temple, for instance, of Amun. And there's like a 60-step ritual process for opening the temple each morning. Greeting the god, feeding the god, clothing the god, and then reversing out of the temple. So I don't know how many hours a day a ruler has to do anything else.
Right. Some people
apart
might say
from this, right? Totally, service-driven kind of life.
Yeah, exactly. They were the high priest. They were the top priest, and some might say that's a bit of a golden cage, right? I mean, yes, you're gonna be king.
Only from the perspective of the persona that we inhabit as a modernity.
Yes.
Any restriction of our will, of our so to speak,
and the ego.
But here we're looking at a society in which the self is splintered across, could be up to, I think in the Doan case, it was 8 or 9 different fundamental elements, each of which could be subdivided again into another 8 or 9. Right. So that the persona is a constellation of bits rather mm-hmm. than a unified whole.
Well, we see, I mean, I think it's common parlance within spiritual circles nowadays to talk about the ego and the higher self and these various parts of self. And it is common to treat the higher self as very distinct from the ego. And so, I mean, even within, modern spiritual circles, the partition of the self into multiple aspects is there. Right. And so, absolutely. Like, if we start talking about the body and the mind and the ego and the higher self, we're already up to, 4 different pieces.
If you've done constellation therapy, you'll know there's also an ancestral stream flowing into this and changing the way you react day to day and changing the kind of events.
Yeah. And so do you see similar partitions of the soul occurring in Egypt, or are they, because otherwise it could be, they're talking about very philosophical notions of personhood, and or is it more about this felt experience of the various parts of the personality of the self?
It's really difficult to understand, because we have a kind of terminology, like 8 or 9 words that are familiar to most people, of which car and bar and Ack and the body and shoe. But to make a translation of those terms to anything that makes sense to us is massively difficult, because you end up with a kind of very bland, the bar is the soul. But, you know, that's just substituting one unknown for another equally obtuse term. You know, what is soul? You can't break it up. You can't break it down into some meaningful units of discourse. Okay, it's the soul, you know. Okay, it lives forever. Oh, fine. Well, that's the bar. Well, there's something missing in this discourse. And again, I think it's the performative context is lacking.
Right.
And I would suggest that the performative context, like in constellation therapy, makes the ancestral line into something you understand as a force flowing through a particular line of people. We're missing right. that with the Egyptian terminology. We don't have the context anymore. So all we can do is kind of drag these terms over the fence and try and make sense of them in terms of modern psychology, which, I mean, you might as well assign random meaning to the words. So there's something missing in our discourse and in our understanding of the construct of personality. I mean, across Africa, never mind ancient Egypt, across African ethnographies, it's like yeah. oblique. Even right. after ethnographic study, it remains puzzling to us.
No, it's very curious. And do you see any shifts in Egyptian religion? As in, we talked before the interview about this kind of interplay between pastoralists and agrarian. Do you feel that, first off, we should probably delve into that? And also, do you feel like both parts of that were still animist, or were there changes going on in terms of theology and practice?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, Egyptian culture was a continuum up to probably the Persian invasion around 600 BC, and then Alexander the Great. At which point it definitely pivoted into a Hellenistic culture. Okay, so talking about ancient Egypt for me is everything prior to that. What seems to me the most significant thing are the so-called intermediate periods in Egyptian culture. So you have Old Kingdom, Middle, and New. Okay, and the intermediate periods were fundamental descent into chaos, famine, and starvation. So they, for instance, you know, they built the huge pyramids up to the end of the Old Kingdom, and then there was a deterioration in that. Well, I see that as a loss of faith. But essentially, if the king was the god and the gateway to everything, then you shouldn't have had a famine lasting 100 and 150 years that killed a certain proportion of the population. Okay, that would be fundamentally undermining. And so the Middle Kingdom has a different mood about it. The kind of ritual architecture and the kinds of rituals change, it seems to me. And again, at the second intermediate period, the New Kingdom emerges with this new ritual process for the god Amun to become the father of the ruler. That's fairly new. I don't see that before. So yeah, there seems to be over very large periods of time and interspersed with major societal collapses. Right. I don't know if that kind of answers it. You know, no. It's a huge period of time we're trying to condense into this like 30-minute chat. So we're talking about how many thousand years if we add the pre-dynastic build-up. So that's mm-hmm. like 5,000 or 4,000 BC all the way to 600 BC.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about
3,500 years of kind of turbulence.
Yeah, we're talking about huge swaths of time. And what's amazing about that is that there is even any connectivity over that 4,000 years. I mean, that even anything close to the same deities were being worshipped, or, you know, there's, it really is astounding.
Yeah.
And so I suppose one of the biggest changes then that you noted is this interaction between Upper and Lower Egypt, and this the pastoralists versus the agrarian cults. Can you tell us more about that, and, you know, who their deities were, and how that kind of interrelation played out?
Again, it's very speculative, because we're right back at the dawn of Egyptian civilization here. But one clear marker for me, at least, is the Nabta Playa site in the Western Desert. It's away from the Nile. But for the first time there, we see a cluster of symbolic markers, okay, which we will then see kind of echoes of throughout the forthcoming millennia. And one of them is the alignment of stones set in the ground with stellar alignments, okay? Cattle burials facing west, okay? And the fact that there's clear signs of ceremonial and sacrificial activity around this center, okay? So it obviously marked a kind of important inflection point in the emergence of what would become ancient Egypt. You know, because we, you know, the stellar alignments, the burials, the rituals, the ascendancy of the cattle is so characteristic of all these pastoral tribal cultures, would then get carried into the Nile Valley. And with the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt, crudely speaking, around what, 3,500 maybe, I don't know, you see an overlay of two distinct cultures, one pastoralist and one agrarian. And of course, a huge duplication of deities, which then kind of merge and mingle. And it gets very confusing, because there were also local deities and hundreds of spirits on every kilometer of the 1,000-odd miles of the Nile, all the way up to the Delta. You know, of course, you had influences from the Levant, you know, the trade routes connecting Egypt with the rest of the Aegean and the Mediterranean, well established, 2000 or 1500 BC. You know, so, you know, you have lapis lazuli from Afghanistan, tin, copper from Cyprus, you know, for the bronze. We're talking about a very complex ecosystem covering the Near East. So switching like from the pastoralist coming in from the desert as it got drier and drier into the Nile Valley, you're encountering a set of deities and a ritual pattern set to the vegetation deity, which was common throughout the Near East. So, for instance, we have Dionysus in Greece. We have Fufluns amongst the Etruscans, Liberpater amongst the Romans, and then Phrygia, Attis, Adonis in the Levant, Telepinu in Anatolia, and down to Temos or Damuzi in Mesopotamia. And all these vegetation deities have a fairly common kind of symbolic language and ritual process around this death and rebirth. Okay, so we recognize that in Osiris and in the story, the famous myth story of Osiris, Horus, Isis, and Nephthys and Set. So what I'm seeing there is two distinct elements in the ritual culture. One is this dying and reborn deity, and the other is in this kind of I call this cattle cult, kind of ecstatic ritualism coming in from the desert. And there's a kind of continuity between these discontinuous spiritual traditions. There's a merger or an overlap rather than a merger that makes for a very unique set of ritual practices. And this is what I'm trying to explore in my, you know, forthcoming work. And by the way, we're running a course on this in January. I don't know if anyone knows, but 11th, 18th, and 25th of January, I'm going to run a course on Egyptian mysteries in which we can explore in three sessions a lot of these topics, looking at the ethnography of mystery initiation in more detail, because we have first-hand accounts of initiation, but they don't start until the first and second centuries CE. You know, and that's interesting in itself. It's almost as like there was no confessional literature before then. And then, you know, you have Plutarch and Apuleius and Cicero and various start writing about the experience of initiation. And it probably reaches its pinnacle with Proclus, who writes quite explicitly about the ritual nature of initiation and what you experience during it. But, you know, we're now into the 5th and 6th century CE. So we're kind of miles away from the ancient Egypt by now. It's like we've had Hellenism, now we're in late antiquity before you have these confessional accounts. But we can compare those with accounts from modern Hindo-Tibetan deity yoga.
Okay.
So again, there's this ethnographic continuity within the discontinuities of culture. So we're kind of assembling the pieces to try and create the jigsaw, the larger picture of how this was done and what it actually delivered.
Right. And I'm really curious, do you think that there was a difference in terms of the ritual pattern of the agrarian Egypt versus the more pastoral Egypt? I mean, it almost reminds me, of course, it reminds me of the Bible, where you have Cain and Abel going at it. You know, they each represent pastoralist and agrarian, farmer and herder. And of course, then, you know, God favors one over the other. Do you see any evidence in Egypt of kind of differences in focus or in terms of how the ritual drama plays out differently?
I think with Egypt, because they established a theocratic state, essentially, everything is subsumed under the ruler. And I think that was the key event, because otherwise you could not reconcile all of the cultures that were being compressed into the Nile Valley. Pastoralists, agrarians, you know, Delta to Upper Nile. So it's almost as though you pile so much in, you had a vertical growth in terms of organization. So if so many people are going to live on top of each other, you need an elaborate structure to organize it. You know, it's not like you're living in an expansive space where everyone can do their own thing. It's more like, you know, a society or culture, like, for instance, in England, where space is limited, and therefore you get highly organized forms. You know, people queue very correctly, they park correctly. There has to be adaptation for the loss of freedom of movement. And I think that's what happened. That's how I conceive of the elaboration of a theocratic state with its priesthood, like a very tall pyramid, you know. And yet, at the same time, it seems to possess an enormous unity. It's not like it's a disharmonious state. It's a kind of selfless state. And I think for the modern mind, this is difficult for us to grasp.
It almost harkens back to what we were saying earlier, where, well, to my mind, they definitely weren't worshiping the ego of the Pharaoh. They were worshiping something behind him, something that he was fulfilling.
Yeah.
I'm curious, does this have any bearing on, you mentioned pyramid in terms of a metaphorical pyramid, but how, very open-ended question, how do the pyramids factor into Egyptian mysteries?
They don't, in my worldview. They're a kind of outlier, you know, the bizarre manifestation of this total reliance upon a theocratic state is almost, well, if this is the God, then we need to erect these structures in some way. Now, the connection is lost because some people say they were mortuary structures. And other people say there's no evidence they were ever mortuary structures. So I'm not in a position to debate that. I don't know. I've been in the Great Pyramid. I've seen it. It seems an unlikely tomb, you know, but then my concept of Egyptian tombs is more like Valley of the Kings, Valley of the Queens. But they, you know, it's a very confusing architecture. You know, it seems to have arisen from nothing. They didn't have it in the pre-dynastic period, and it kind of faded out over time with the Middle Kingdom. So I just don't have the answer to that one. What purpose did it serve? It definitely seems to be connected to the life of the spirit. I have no doubt about that because of the passageways, which seem to have aligned with key, you know, again, our stellar alignments from nap to player are back in play here. But I'm not aware of any evidence of an actual burial in these structures, but I may be wrong. Some of them definitely have mortuary chambers, for instance, underground. I'm thinking the Step Pyramid and, you know, they don't all seem to be the same architecture to me, but I'm not sure.
That's the thing. The Great Pyramid really stands out. I mean, I believe that on that same plateau, you know, you have obviously the three giant pyramids, and then you have all the little pyramids for their wives and such that were built around it. I believe that there's definitely been mummies found there. But yeah, the Great Pyramid is just such an outlier. They never found any evidence.
So stark.
And there's no hieroglyphs on the inside.
Yeah,
there's
so stark.
They had to allegedly find, you know, this graffiti in the upper chambers of the pyramid to even tie it to Khufu, right? So it's quite something. I guess that's the thing. Yeah. So far in the past, who knows, right?
Yeah. There's certainly a lot of mysteries around Egypt. You know, we just can't quite grasp.
Absolutely. But then again, there are some things that we do know. And one of those, in fact, you've been looking into quite a bit. Can you tell us more about your work on the opening the mouth ritual and looking at funerary texts and such to see what's going on there?
Based on my work with the Near Eastern vegetation deities, it was clear to me that their initiatory cycles were fixed around this birth-death cycle. And that gave an initiatory moment based on their myth cycle. So I was looking for the same thing in relationship to Osiris, who was another vegetation deity, essentially. And sure enough, when I look at the opening of the mouth ritual, which is a characteristic of all the great funerary reliefs and papyri, it's like, you know, a pivotal moment. It's clear that they seem to be welcoming a newborn into the world. Okay, that's the kind of mythic moment. So that moment of birth is like the crux of a ritual process that they've built up to, and it includes this kind of Hathoric element. all of the vegetation deities are lamented. But the lament is not just a random mourning. It's a call for the deity to come. It's an invocation. And that's the role of the kind of what I call the Hathoric musicians, the cohort of musicians and dancers from the pastoral culture, is to recall the deity. And in doing so, they create a moment at which an initiation can occur. That's to say, the deity will come down into a person or into a corpse, if necessary, a temple, a statue. Because the same ritual is like purpose built to sanctify something, to turn it into sacred.
Yeah, I mean, it's a core part of theurgy to draw the deity into that statue and bring the divine here, yeah. Right? So yeah. it's so incredibly important. Mm. And do you think that this was a practice that they were doing throughout Egyptian? As in, is this something that you think goes way back to the beginning of Egyptian civilization? Where
I think, yeah,
it almost has shamanic roots or something. What do you think?
Well, I think it goes back to the Upper Paleolithic invocation of deity, you know, that we see depicted on the walls of caves and rock shelters. Groups of ritualists and a very large figure that they're kind of assimilated to. So this question of how come this type of possession cult, which I think is characterized 95% plus of the world's cultures have some form of possession cult, it's that ubiquitous, is like the root core of the mystery tradition. So it's accompanied us from the beginning of an identifiable human culture 35,000 years ago up to today. And yet we've lost the sense of it and how to do it.
It's a very difficult thing for naturalist, physicalist, materialist thinkers to understand, isn't it? The role of possession. But it's there throughout literally every other culture and throughout time. And to understand that, I mean, that is one of the core ways that you can connect in an animist way or connect in that felt experience with the divine. And I suppose that's why Egypt feels so alien. It's we can't come to grasp with their spiritual system.
Yeah. And I think that's true of the Vajrayana tradition today. You know, the kinds of initiations in the Indo-Tibetan higher yoga tantra are bizarre to any rationalist mindset. You know, because they deliver the same thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And it's kind of shocking that such a thing is accessible today, albeit through a series of oaths, and, you know, the actual practice is quite onerous. You have to be prepared to do the sadhana for quite a substantial period every single day to make that system work for you as a yogic practice. But nevertheless, the influx of divine energy is a very real feature of it.
So if you were to go
amazing.
If you were to go out on a limb and hypothesize what was involved around the opening the mouth ceremony, in other words, what were these priests doing to prepare themselves, or to what do you think was the behind the scenes stuff going on? You know, having looked at similar traditions and similar practices like Vajrayana, what do you think was going on there?
What is clear to me is that the notion of a spiritual lineage and being born into a spiritual lineage was quite fundamental to all the mystery cults. So for instance, Eleusis, they said the goddess gave us this. And it's like it's mentioned in the Homeric hymn to Demeter. So we can date it to like the 8th century BC. And it continued right through until the closure of the sanctuary. And then, as I mentioned in the book, Hagia Sophia, the granddaughter was prepared and initiated and taught how to continue the initiation of Eleusis after the sanctuary was destroyed and closed in a normal house in Athens, at least till the end of the 5th century. Okay, so that is 1,200 years of continuous initiatory lineage just in that one context. Okay, so lineage is fundamental, and we're back again with this ancestral thing, which as a considered as an autonomous force acting through time, would tend to bring the same spiritual tradition to people within a certain lineage, whether they were aware of that or not. And in fact, you know, in the tradition of hands-on healing that I practice and that I see practiced in Central Asia, it's all lineage-based. People discover that they have this healing energy. And then when they interrogate the family background, they find that there's a stream of people behind them who also have the energy. Okay, so just because it's modern doesn't mean it's, you know, recent. It's this is a modern manifestation of an extremely ancient feature of human cultural evolution. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that it makes us shift away from an understanding of initiation as a form of gatekeeping. You know, you have to join the club in order to do these things. It's more like a recognition of of your ancestral line and your past and maybe the oversoul that is within your family. And
it's your openness to the notion of service. You know, without that, there's nothing. Proclus also was very clear. He says, you know, the gods want to manifest themselves. It's not like you're doing a magical rite to force something to happen. It's not like that. It's the degree to which you assimilate yourself to their energy already that flings the doors of awareness open to the fact that they're present. Okay.
I mean, that's huge. Absolutely. You have to put yourself aside for any kind of possession practice, right? I mean, you're not there. You have to be willing to submit or to yield.
So, as soon as you engage in a service-based orientation to life, you are aligned with some spiritual energies. There's no doubt about that. And whether you're aware of it or not is kind of by the by. I mean, that's not the point. The point is the service, right? But the more closely aligned you are with certain spiritual elements in that service, the more you will feel the beneficial or the providential flow of energy to yourself.
So do you feel like, and obviously we're talking about a 6,000-year-old history or 6,000-year history. Do you feel that Egypt might have been at certain times basically united in service? You have the Pharaoh who's dedicated to this life of service, and then the state functions almost like an appendage of him to bring that service to the rest of society. Like, do you feel like that was kind of the dynamic that was going on? That
I mean, very often we think the priesthood were like isolated. They weren't. The top edge of the priesthood were the royal family. The lower parts of the priesthood were some very competent people running estates. The rest of the priesthood served 3 months of the year in the temple. The other 9 months, they were in their communities. They were married, they had children, they had land, they were practicing whatever their speciality was in the priesthood in their local community. So there's a, you know, we tend to think of the society as segmented, you know, on the vertical, but actually it kind of flowed. Priesthood flowed back into their communities and worked there 9 months of the year. 3 months they'd be back at the temple doing their duties there to keep the temple functioning.
That is fascinating.
So, you know, that's a real different perspective on this. And then the other strange thing is that there's a tendency towards miniaturization. Mm. So that whatever hieratic rituals are enacted in the inner sanctums of the great temples, there's a kind of reflection of them downwards. So let's take a concrete example. You have the burial or the funerary rites of a ruler. You know, it's as hieratic as it gets, right? Top priesthoods enact this ritual. But then the ritual gets written down. It gets inscribed on the walls of temples and on subsequently lower levels of society, they reflect that into their own mortuary apparatus and finally ends up on a piece of papyrus, you know, which is wrapped around the mummy. So, you know, there's a flow down of ritual practice, a miniaturization, and even you find the references to the opening of the mouth ceremony in the PGM, the Greco-Magical Papyri, as a way of sanctifying a brooch or a ritual object. Okay, so the smallest, the tiniest ritual you can enact is still a mirror of the great opening of the mouth ceremony for the burial of a ruler or the initiation of a high priest. So it's these continuities and the tendency towards miniaturizing is so interesting.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Far more fluid view of ancient Egypt than, you know, they're like the hieratic separation of everything.
Right, right. You know? That's the thing, the living culture, right? I mean, it has flowed back and forth. That, I mean, that's exactly. And you have to wonder then, well, actually, it comes as no surprise that in the PGM, you know, which is basically, you know, for the listener who might not have heard about this yet, it's basically a magical textbook by a Greco, what would you say, Greco-Roman or Greco-Egyptian? Greco-Egyptian, actually. Practicing magician. Yeah. And it's a book of spells. You know, it was what he was doing practically on a day-to-day basis to work with the divinities. Yeah. And you know, why would a piece of tech like the opening of the mouth ceremony not find its way down there? I mean, it would just be so essential to that society. Yeah. And one question.
There's an excellent essay about this by a guy Smith, the surname. I think it's actually called Miniaturization. Talks about this. It's well worth looking up.
Interesting. And and the priesthood, were they coming from certain family lines, or were they, like, how were they being selected?
Again, this thing of lineage was important for the high priesthood. You know, if you're embodying an initiatory tradition, you know, that's something which the community knows. You know, it could be a healing practice. But others were people who, you know, were just talented from the villages and were able to get an education sufficient for them to enter the priesthood. I mean, it was a huge institution. It ran the country at times of civil disorder, you know, especially the priesthood of Amun, you know, just there's no ruler or we're invaded, countries in disorder. Well, the priesthood just runs everything, collects all the crops, you know, apportions the food. It's like the civil service and the priesthood combined, all in one unit. And totally open to the communities that it's serving. I say the flow in and out of the hierarchy of priests was total, up and down and side to side. And you would have people who were in the lower priesthood may marry into the royal family. There's certainly cases like that, you know.
Right.
And the whole thing is far more organic than you would suppose.
And it's so curious because this idea of lineage never really goes away. And of course, it also shows up in your other work on the game of Saturn, in which you have royal families trying to be reborn into the same lifestyle for the same lineage as well.
And we're back at constellation therapy and the fact that these lineages seem to be operative forces. In other words, if you wanted to escape that, that would be difficult.
Right, right. And
it's
so
it's not just a question of making it happen, is maybe you don't want it to happen, and it still happens. So it has this autonomy about it. And so by ritualizing it, you're strengthening something that's already there, in essence.
Right. You can make a virtue out of a vice. If it's going to happen anyways, might as well make it beneficial placement you can have.
Just perhaps to contextualize the game of Saturn a little, I mean, one of the things that I labored under when I wrote that piece was a kind of Gnostic dualism. And it was only subsequently I came to realize that that is not a part of the Hellenistic tradition that was conveyed from Byzantium to the Renaissance. Okay, it's a Christian or Judeo-Christian thing. It's not part of Hellenism intrinsically, that dualism. So the anything negative seeming around the Sola Busca ritualism had more to do with the nature of the energy that was being, which was a martial energy that was being invoked. And the reason a martial energy was so important is that for a small city-state on the edge of Venice's ever-expanding interests, you needed to be very effective martially to survive. Okay, it wasn't a question of an evil something or other. It was a question of day-to-day survival, which fell on the Duke's shoulders. I mean, he's the guy, year in, year out, had to go out there at the head of an army to earn the money to keep the state functioning. It was his job, you know, and so 6-8 months of a year, he'd be on horseback in field conditions to earn the income to keep the state alive or to go and fend off Vatican forces or the French or the Venetians or whoever else. So that context changes the way I read the kind of ritual processes in this Sola Busca. This invocation of this draconian force has a kind of positive spin on it now in my mind. What else could you do in that situation if you're responsible for everyone's safety? You have to man up. You have to man up, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So the draconian force is appropriate in that context. That's what you need to do it.
And it's basically saying, okay, this life is rough. It's there's a lot of, and not seeing it in terms of dualism, but rather, okay, I have to ally myself with the energy that will give me the power to get through this. Right?
Yeah.
Exactly. So,
Do you I think see that's any... the biggest change I've had with interpreting, you know, that work.
Right.
It's good for me to say it as a corrective. I don't see it as something inherently evil. I don't believe that anymore. It was not intended. And the guy who brought it from Byzantium to the Renaissance certainly had the view that looking at the Byzantine state being eaten alive by the Ottoman forces, you know, to devise a ritual like this looked like the only way of saving the Hellenistic cultural inheritance. That's why that ritual process was devised, I believe.
Would that have been Python who was doing
yeah.
Okay, Python, yes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Interesting.
I can't think of anyone else who was, you know, could have done that. And he was open when he advised the emperor and his son, the Byzantine emperor. He was an advisor to them, and he says, you know, you have to take extreme measures, or this entire culture is going to end with you. And actually, he was right. They couldn't stop the influx of Ottoman rule.
Right, right. Now, I think that's also something we forget is the amount of horror that was around in these other time periods. I mean, yes, we have horror in today's world, but it's mediated by television, and a great many people never face it as a possibility in their lives. And yet, when we're talking about the ancient world, the threat of invasion was very real and ever present.
Also, it's kind of mediated by like transnational organizations today, you know, that can direct aid and assistance. They can put pressure and this kind of thing. So that didn't exist then. You know, you were on your own.
And you faced the possibility of utter annihilation or slavery. And so shifting focus to Egypt, then you can see why a strong theocratic state in that situation was very important, because you needed a functioning state to keep the chaos at bay. I'm curious, do you see anything that rhymes with what you noticed in the context of the Sola Busca deck? Do you see any activities that were being done by the priesthood or by everyday people or the royalty to incarnate in certain ways, or to really manage that ancestral line? Like, obviously there's conventions and taboos around marriage and such, but do you see any more spiritual things that were being done to kind of work with that ancestral lineage and lineage in general?
I think the sheer number of temples, priesthoods, and daily activity was absolutely enormous. I mean, it's like nothing else went on in the state. Okay, they had an army, but as far as I can see, everything else was just this machinery of interacting with the other side. And I say it was an open-ended machinery at the bottom. It flowed out into the society. It was not closed off in any way. You know, the organization that it brought meant that there were crops, you know, they avoided famine. Unless there was really a climatic disaster, as happened with the first intermediate period, you know, and that affected the entire planet, by the way. Otherwise, they ran a highly functional state from what I can see. You know, I don't know what more I can say, really. You know, they were in balance with their means.
And honestly, that's quite the achievement, doing that over over 6,000 years.
Yeah.
Oh man, it's absolutely, absolutely fascinating. Mm. I think, is there any other part of your research that you would like to allow the listener to dip their toe into at this point?
Well, really, this is kind of all consuming at the moment. I've done a few other things that perhaps people are not aware of. I wrote the foreword to a forthcoming work by Dara Mason, for instance. This August, it'll be out. It's on the Dark Man of the Witches' Sabbath.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and what Dara has done there, he's collected, the book is in two parts. He's collected all the folklore from Ireland related to the dark man appearing and doing stuff. Okay.
Right.
So that's been quite well preserved in the Irish tradition. It's quite pure. And then he's collected experiences, accounts, firsthand accounts, contemporary accounts of encounters with the dark man.
So this is, for the listener who might not know, this is referring to the being who would bring witches to the witches' Sabbath in folklore and within church accounts. What did they find? What's being found on this account?
Well, the strange thing is the dark man, like most of these spiritual forces, remains kind of ineffable.
Hmm.
That's to say that as a personality that we would understand, they never come into three-dimensional shape. They like flit on the edge of personhood, beckoning, so to speak, but behind them seems like a void. So it's so liminal. It's just sufficient to interact with our consciousness as a phenomena. But it always points towards a fundamental transformation.
And so this is, it sounds like even in the accounts then of this dark man, it is like this liminal being, like it's not appearing as a full-fledged person.
Sometimes it is, but it's kind of fleetingly so.
Interesting.
And sometimes it's like just looking into a space with no color.
Interesting.
And the interactions are very bizarre as well. So as the accounts progress and we move towards practitioners, it becomes far more integrated into a spiritual life. And that's another interesting aspect. So it's almost like initially like a trickster figure who interacts with you, but not in a way which you can like encompass mentally, and therefore initiates a series of changes in your own spiritual orientation.
From spirit practice, I can definitely understand how a spirit could do that exactly, just causing changes, dreams, synchronicities, experiences that you're not quite in control of that are bringing you somewhere.
So anyway, I've written the foreword to this as an extended essay, and it'll be out from Inner Traditions. It's already available for pre-order on Amazon, The Song of the Dark Man of the Witch's Sabbath. So, you know, that could be very interesting for some people because of the firsthand accounts in there, which is very rare. I can't think of another text which covers this material, actually. That's why I mention it. You know, I've got the course in January through the Magical Egypt people. Mm-hmm. If anyone's interested, it's a 3-part course, and we'll explore the ethnography of firsthand accounts of mystery initiation, ancient and some modern accounts we have. I'll discuss in the second module the influence of the Egyptian mysteries on the Western esoteric understanding, and also Philippe de Scola's animism, naturalism, and how that shift helps us, as we've discussed today, in trying to understand the Egyptian worldview. And then the third module will look at some of the ritual practices in more detail. You know, I've got two forms of practice, one to birth to Amun, and the other one via the classical opening of the mouth ritual. So that's going on in January. I've done a number of reviews, and the Esoteric Tarot came out in December. Oh, a conversation between myself and Christophe Poncet. And in that, I wanted to write a definitive text on the topic of the Esoteric Tarot. So that is available on Amazon. It's available as an ebook on Amazon. It's available with beautiful hardback from Scarlet Imprint, if anyone's interested. But that for me is, you know, a kind of definitive text. My own part, I'm able to reflect on the solar busker like from a higher level view. Christophe Poncet is reflecting on the Terre de Marseille tradition. And he positions that with Marsilio Ficino and the artwork of Botticelli. And that's really interesting for me because I wasn't aware of that interpretation.
Ficino, so that's making it very Neoplatonic then.
Exactly. That for me was fascinating, that the Tarot de Marseille, which is like the ground zero of tarot imagery, right? The symbolism should have that root. Okay, that's fascinating. And that very much complements the work I did on the solar busker, because we're in the same zone, so to speak. They're both like spanning off the works brought by Giovanni Aurispa, 1423, 1426. He brought complete works, Plato, Proclus, Plotinus, and most of Iamblichus to Italy from Constantinople. And that inaugurated, in my mind, a second Hellenistic revolution. The first Renaissance had been Latin, the discovery of the Latin literary heritage. Okay? The second revolution was Hellenistic. So it's the second Renaissance, effectively. And as far as I can see, the solar busker and the Tarot de Marseille embodied the core of this liturgic or liturgically driven tradition. So that is very available, actually. You know, the esoteric tarot, as I say, it's available as a fine hardback and as easy to access ebook or print on demand book on Amazon. You know, we wanted to make sure that we're inexpensive editions available to anyone, to meet anyone's pocket, essentially. You know, so that is out there. And I've done reviews of various books, which are up on Paralibrum. If anyone, you know, most good reviews of esoteric works end up on paralibrum.com. So, which is run in Germany. It has a three-way kind of process of checking reviews that are written, that they have a decent literary and content quality. So I reviewed Gasbouchet's Anarch. And then, as you say, I had the book on the Hagia Sophia out. And that's been it for 2023. So 2024, we're in Egypt. Up to our necks in Egypt.
I'm looking forward to what comes out of that. I mean, Egypt, it opens up so many possibilities in terms of wisdom and knowledge to bring to the reader. So that's fantastic. Well, Peter, this has been an absolutely fantastic conversation. And where can people find you? Pardon me?
Bit of an update.
Oh yes. Oh yes. Yeah. No, you get up to a lot in a year and a half. So, and where can people find you online? What are your social media websites?
PeterMarkAdams.com or, you know, Instagram or X or Facebook or so. I just use my name, nothing to hide.
Fantastic. Well, I'll
find the course at magicalegyptstore.com. If they're interested in the January's course. I don't know when you'll broadcast this, so it may be too late for that. We'll see.
I know. I'll try to get it up soon just to make sure you have some coverage for that event. That sounds like a lot of fun. I think my listeners will really enjoy that. So yeah, I'll have all the information down in the show notes below. This has been fantastic. I'm really curious. We'll have to touch base in another year and a half and see what other mysteries you've gone to. Awesome. Well, Peter, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me, Eric. It's always a pleasure to catch up and chat through stuff with you.